Genesis 24, verse 67, it reads, "Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death." The word honeymoon is a wonderful word. Whether yours was 2 weeks in Hawaii or 2 days in Panama City Beach, it was a romantic highlight. Just the word conjures up warm feelings, pleasant memories, you and your honey all by yourself spending time together. I've read several definitions of the word honeymoon. Here's one. A honeymoon is a thrill of a lifetime. How about this? It's the period between I do and you'd better. Or it's the vacation that a man takes before starting to work for a new boss. Or maybe it's the morning after the not before. Actually, the word honeymoon was coined to describe the first moon or the first month of the marriage. Apparently, it's the first month. It's the honeymoon that's the sweetest and the tastiest time in the marriage. But for every marriage, there comes a point when the honeymoon ends. One man observed, "The honeymoon is over when he phones that he'll be late for dinner and she's already left a note that it's in the refrigerator." I've heard this, "The honeymoon is over when your dog brings you your slippers and your wife barks at you." Or, "The honeymoon is over when he finds out he married a big spender and she finds out she didn't." Every honeymoon eventually comes to an end and the marriage begins. It's been said marriage is like a violin. You can make beautiful music, but when the music stops, the strings are still attached. Real love is not a love that lasts for a few days or a few months, but for a lifetime. You know, people talk about love at first sight. What impresses me most is love at the 18,250th sight. Did you know that if you've been married for 50 years, you'll wake up and you'll look at your spouse 18,250 times? Hey, when you're married 50 years, you see the good and the bad. You see the sweet and the sour. Real love is not as exciting as it is enduring. It's love for the long haul. And yet the sad truth is that marital love can grow stale. Love can get lost in the commotion of life. Love can begin well, but that doesn't mean it will bloom well. Such was the case with Isaac and Rebekah. At first, it seemed their honeymoon would never end, but it did. Isaac and Rebekah stopped communicating, and as a result, an avalanche of mistakes followed in their marriage. As a result, their harmony, the happiness in their home, was short-lived. Tonight, I want us to look just briefly at the three phases of what became a distant marriage. We'll call them love at first sight, then love at first slight, then love at first spite. Remember Isaac. He was the promised son of Abraham and Sarah. He was the fulfillment of the covenant that God made with Abram and his descendants, that his descendants would be God's people, a special people, a divine tribe. Isaac was one of the patriarchs of the nation Israel. Isaac was also a privileged son. When Abraham died, Isaac inherited all of his wealth, his vast holdings. Isaac was also a pious son. He was a man of faith. When Abraham was called by God to scale the mountain called Moriah and offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice, Isaac didn't object. And he could have. At the time, Isaac was a grown man, probably in his mid-30s. He was about the age of Jesus, who 2,000 years later allowed his father to offer him as a sacrifice on that same Mount Moriah. We speak a lot of Abraham's faith, but certainly Isaac's faith was equally as impressive. Isaac was a promised son. He was a privileged son. He was a pious son. But he was not a perfect son. For Isaac was also a pampered son. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He never really made his own mark on the world. Isaac was content to ride his daddy's coattails. We're told in Genesis 26, verse 18, Isaac dug again the wells of water which they had dug in the days of Abraham, his father. He didn't even dig his own wells. He reopened the wells of Abraham. You see, Isaac wasn't a man who ventured out. He was happy to just lay back. Isaac followed in his father's footsteps, both in good ways and in bad. You recall when Abraham went to Egypt, he lied about his wife Sarah. Sarah was a beauty. She was a real knockout. But Abraham was afraid of getting knocked off. He instructed Sarah to tell the Egyptians that she was his sister so they wouldn't kill him when they found out that she was his wife. To save his own skin, he threw his wife under the bus. And this wasn't a one-time occurrence in Abraham's life. 20 years later, he goes down to Gaza and he does the exact same thing. Actually, this may have been his habit. In Genesis 20, when Abraham explains his strategy to Sarah, he says, "This is a kindness that you should do for me. In every place, wherever we go, say of me, he is my brother." Parents should pay close attention. When Isaac grows up and his family makes a trip to Gaza, guess what he says to Rebecca? "Honey, you're so beautiful. And I fear for my life. They may kill me to take you. Just tell them you're my sister." Tragically, he follows in the same footsteps of his father. You know, it's a scary thought, but every parent better start thinking about it. Your habitual sins are contagious. There's a great likelihood your children will repeat your same mistakes. Parents, don't underestimate the power of your example, either for good or for bad. It was not until Sarah died that Abraham decided to search for Isaac a wife. Apparently, they previously had been one little happy family. But when Sarah slipped away, Isaac slipped into a funk. He became depressed. In an effort to jar him out of it, Abraham called on his servant Eleazar to go to Abraham's own people, his family living in Haran, and seek out a wife for Isaac. When Eleazar reaches Haran, he decides to pray. He asks the Lord to send a girl who will water his camels, sort of the test that he puts out there. And this was no small task. Eleazar had 10 camels. And I'm sure you know that a camel can drink 25 gallons at a single sitting. That's 250 gallons of water to draw and to fetch. Any woman who would attempt such a kindness would be a giving, sacrificial, unselfish, energetic, hospitable young lady. A very fine catch for Isaac. It was a good plan. Well, before Eleazar could say amen, up walks Rebecca. "Hey, mister, would you like for me to water your camels?" Whoops, there it is. Later, when the story's recounted to Rebecca's family, they marvel and they rightly conclude, "This thing comes from the Lord." I suppose these days this is as close as a parent can get to arranging their child's marriage. Pray and work out a deal with God in advance. I've been praying for my children's future spouses from the time they were born. And so Abram's servant Eleazar proposes to Rebekah on behalf of Isaac, and the young girl accepts. She'd never seen Isaac. She'd only heard about him from the servant. But she travels 500 miles to marry him. Talk about a blind date. This was the ultimate. And I'm sure the trip from Haran to Judah was an exciting one. Rebekah asking questions about her groom, getting to know him through his servant. When Rebekah's caravan finally arrives, she sees Isaac out in the fields. He's meditating on the Lord. In Genesis 24, verse 64, we find the first case of cigarette smoking in the Bible. As the old King James puts it, she lighted off her camel. Not sure if it was filtered or unfiltered. Actually, she jumped down and ran into his arms. It was love at first sight. And we're told in chapter 24, verse 67, "Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death." There is no question that Isaac and Rebekah loved each other. Fast forward 40 years. We're told that the Philistine king sees Isaac. And what is he doing? He's smooching with his wife. Genesis 26, verse 8 says they were caressing. These lovebirds had been married 40 years and the fire was still burning. There was plenty of passion in their relationship. In fact, as it turns out, when Rebecca discovers she's barren, that she can't have children, rather than get mad, rather than become bitter or depressed, Isaac gives his wife the greatest favor that a husband can give his wife. He prays for her. Men, do you pray for your wife? Husband, your wife may be going through a period of barrenness herself. Oh, she might have several children, but maybe she's barren in other ways. Perhaps she's enduring a spiritual drought. Or maybe she's at a place in her life where she's dried up emotionally and seriously depressed. We're told in Genesis 25, verse 21, "Now Isaac pleaded for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived." Just goes to show that God really loves to hear and answer a husband's prayer for his wife. Men, intercede for your Rebekah, and God will make her fruitful in lots of ways. But here's what I want you to notice about Isaac and Rebekah. Though they were close physically, we see them petting. And though they were close spiritually, we see Isaac praying. There was still a problem. There was a bond physically and spiritually, but emotionally, there was a distance. You see, what began as love at first sight soon became love at first slight. They slighted each other and they shortchanged their marriage. There were several problems in this relationship. First, remember, when Isaac took Rebekah to be his wife, we're told that he brought her into Sarah's tent. Sarah's tent? Ladies, how would you feel if your newlywed husband wanted to spend his wedding night in your dead mother-in-law's bedroom? Is that not creepy? Isaac had been close to his mom. It's possible, even probable, that she had been overprotective of her only son. Her mothering love had become a smothering love. Sarah sheltered Isaac from many of life's hardships. Rather than grow into a man and learn to stand on his own two feet, perhaps Isaac had found it easier to yield tough decisions to his mother, sort of hide behind his mom's apron strings. A helicopter mom ran his life. I really shudder when I read that phrase. It's so laced with innuendo. Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. In a sense, Rebekah took the place of Sarah in Isaac's life. She was a talented and capable woman. It was easy for Isaac to capitulate leadership. Rather than be his wife, Rebekah mothered Isaac. Over time, Isaac became the passive husband for whom Rebekah lost respect. And Rebekah became the manipulating wife from whom Isaac withdrew. You know, some infertile couples believe that if you can just have a baby, it'll solve all their problems. But for Isaac and Rebekah, it actually revealed their problems. Rebekah's pregnancy was so difficult, she couldn't understand why, and so she prayed and she asked the Lord. And God spoke to her, Genesis 25, verse 23. He said, "Two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." Of course, this prophecy was fulfilled with their twins, Esau and Jacob. But what's provocative about the story is that Genesis never records Rebekah sharing this promise with Isaac. Never. The only time Rebekah is mentioned outside the book of Genesis is Romans 9, verse 12. And there the scripture makes a point of affirming that this promise was spoken exclusively to Rebekah. Paul writes, "It was said to her, the older shall serve the younger." My point is that Isaac and Rebekah had apparently stopped talking. They had ceased communicating, even about the important stuff. This couple had grown distant. Amazingly, an issue of this magnitude, I mean a direct promise of God, had never been discussed between them. Isaac could talk to God about Rebekah, But Isaac and Rebekah couldn't talk to each other about God. Did you hear about the hard of hearing couple? They were coming home from their 70th wedding anniversary. The old man says to his wife, "Honey, after 70 wonderful years together, I have found you tried and true." His wife got angry. She shot back. "And after 70 years, I'm tired of you too." Proving that a lack of communication can be a real problem in a marriage. There was once a couple who raised and pickled cucumbers. The husband liked to watch things grow, so he took care of the planting, while the wife liked to work in the kitchen, and so she did the pickling. When the man died, the kids came over to plow the garden for Mom. But the mother said, "No thanks, guys. I've never really liked cucumbers. I only pickled them because your dad wanted to grow them." The youngest son heard it and he got upset. He said, "Wait a minute, just a few days before Dad died, he told me that the only reason he planted the garden was to give you something to do in the kitchen." You know, on the one hand, it was commendable that they loved each other. They put each other first. They sacrificed for one another. But they could have saved themselves a lot of grief and a lot of wasted effort if they'd simply talked and shared some feelings. Husband, when you come home from work, you say you're too tired to talk to your wife, or maybe you're too busy, or you say perhaps you don't care enough anymore, or maybe you don't always know how to express your feelings. The answer is not to withdraw. Isaac withdrew. He withdrew from his wife. Don't withdraw. If you're too tired, save some energy. If you're too busy, make some time. If you don't care, repent of your sin and love your wife as Christ loves the church. And if you don't know how to talk, you can at least listen. You can be a good listener, and you'll keep open vital lines of communication in your marriage. Famed British author Thomas Carlyle never got over the regret he felt for neglecting his wife. In his diary, there appears a line that has been called the saddest sentence in English literature. Carlyle wrote of his wife, "Oh, that I had you yet for 5 minutes by my side, that I might tell you all." Boy, there's a lot we'd tell our wives if we knew we would never have an opportunity again. One study revealed that 70% of all marital problems involve a silent husband. The guy has shut down. And the more the man withdraws, the less secure the woman feels. And the more she tries to manipulate him to gain control. The more she tries to gain control, the more he withdraws and does his own thing. And you can see what's happening. A vicious cycle gets created. He withdraws. She doesn't trust him. And so she tries to manipulate him. Then he withdraws more. Then she manipulates more. Tries to gain control. I guess we could call this love at first slight. The bitterness and the disappointment start to snowball. Walls go up. Communication becomes impossible. And one day you wake up and you find the wedlock has become a deadlock. As men, we need to work hard to communicate with our wives. And I'll tell you why, guys. For where there's a silent husband, it produces a scheming wife. How can your wife trust you if you never let her into your thought process? How can she be submissive to you unless she knows your plans? Hey, if I were to ask your wife to describe your 5-year plan tonight, would she be able to answer accurately? When women aren't privy to their husband's thoughts, they don't trust them. And if they don't trust their husband, they'll try to take control of the family. Self-preservation. A wife who's kept at a distance resorts to manipulation and in subtle ways tries to force her husband into doing what she wants him to do. Like the fellow who said, "I wouldn't say that my wife always gets her way, but she does write her diary a week ahead of time." Always remember, where communication breaks down, manipulation starts up. Of course, why it happens doesn't make it right, ladies. Moodiness, pouting, sulking, withholding, sexual bargaining. These are all forms of marital manipulation. You know, for some wives, it's become such a habit, they don't realize they're doing it. They've seen Mom do it, and they've seen friends do it. and they no longer see that they're doing it. Ladies, if you've become a manipulator, it's time you stopped and trusted God to guide your husband. You don't have to be in control when God holds the reins. You see, the marriage of Isaac and Rebekah, it included love at first sight, love at first slight, but then also love at first spite. The friction in this marriage soon became evident in the family. It spilled over. Aloof from each other, Isaac and Rebekah sought emotional attachment through their kids. Each parent clung to a different child and played the two against each other. It made a royal mess of her family. Esau was a hunter. He was the rugged guy, the meat and potatoes guy. Isaac saw in his older son Esau the strong independence that he had lacked in his life. He lived out his failed ambitions through his son Esau. Whereas Jacob was Rebekah's favorite, she coddled him. She kept him close at home. Jacob loved to cross stitch and work on floral arrangements. An expert on family matters writes this: while a child may be getting pampered and overindulged by one parent, he is getting criticized and rejected by the other. Neither one does him any good. He grows to disrespect the parent who indulges him and despises the parent who rejects him. Favoritism can be fatal in a family. Isaac and Rebekah were stone cold guilty. Once there was a couple, they were on their way home from Aunt Emma's funeral. This Emma had been a handful. She had been an obstinate old biddy who tortured the family for years. Finally, she died. And on the way home, the husband, he turned to his wife and he confessed. He said, "Honey, I hate to say it, but I'm actually glad your Aunt Emma kicked the bucket." Suddenly, a look of horror swept over the woman's face. She said, "My Aunt Emma? I thought she was your Aunt Emma." This couple had made a horrible, insufferable mistake because they had failed to communicate. See, communication breakdowns affect a family. It's interesting, when the moment came for Isaac to bestow the blessing of the firstborn, it would have been an opportune time for Rebekah to tell her husband about the prophecy she'd received while the boys were still in her womb. But that ship had sailed. The result of slight after slight after slight is a show of spite. Neglect hurts. When you get neglected, it hurts. And when you're left out over and over, you want to take it out on the person that's to blame. You know the story. You know what happens. Isaac goes to bless Esau, and Rebekah, the manipulator, has clothed Jacob in a furry disguise. She's made him feel hairy like Esau. And she's also taken advantage of Isaac's diminished eyesight. She's able to pass Jacob off for Esau. She tricks her husband. Rebekah knew that God intended to bless the younger over the older. I'm sure she assumed she was helping God out. But when it comes to God's will, the ends never justifies the means. God's purposes are fulfilled through love and truth, not through manipulation and deception. Because of Rebekah, Esau ends up enraged. He seeks to kill his brother. Jacob runs from his life, and sadly, Rebekah never sees her favorite son again. She dies without seeing him again. The problems in Isaac and Rebekah's marriage spill over, and they destroy what could have been a happy home. There's so many lessons to be learned here from this story. But it's the textbook case of why couples need to work hard to keep open vital lines of communication. You see, trust is crucial to every marriage. And trust is based on frequent and honest and humble communication. As one Bible commentator writes, trust is essential to any loving relationship. And trust cannot flourish in a home where there is dishonesty and deceit. Husbands and wives who purposely keep things from each other, who sneak around to hide the truth about finances, the activities they're involved in, the things the children have done, or anything else, can never enjoy the fullness of God's love in their relationship. Paul said in Ephesians 4, verse 15, but speaking the truth in love. This is great advice for husbands and wives. Truth doesn't ignore love. And love doesn't ignore truth. They work together. Nothing is gained by concealing our feelings. The truth needs to be out there. But those feelings should be expressed in a caring way. We need to speak the truth in love. Communication involves more than just an emotional rant from time to time. Don't just dump on your spouse or vent and call it communication. It's not healthy communication. Effective dialogue, effective conversation puts the other person in your shoes. We can speak the truth, but we do it in a gentle and in a considerate and in a loving way. Hey, the lesson here for husbands, what you husbands need to learn from Isaac, is you need to get off your duff and you need to re-enter your marriage. You need to re-engage your wife. You need to communicate. Live life with her. Your wife needs to know your inner thoughts. She needs to feel the emotional support that comes from caring communication. No excuse justifies a husband barricading his emotions or bailing out on his wife. A loving leader has to learn to communicate. And to the wives, what the wives should learn? Well, Rebecca's example teaches us that a woman only hurts herself and her children and her family when she seeks to manipulate her husband. Trust God with your husband, or you'll end up messing up your family. Manipulation mars a marriage. It creates problems that surface in the future, problems you live to regret. People with good marriages are those who connect, not just physically and spiritually, but also bond emotionally. And it's the willingness to communicate honestly and openly. This is the key to a good marriage. And when you make the effort, God is certain to bless. But when you don't, love at first sight turns to love at first slight, which turns into love at first spite. May the love in your marriage never deteriorate so far. I pray your honeymoon lasts a lifetime as you learn to trust God and communicate with your spouse.